Good morning. My name is Rohit Verma, and I'm one of the co-chairs of the first Cornell Hospitality Health and Design Symposium. Welcome to our inaugural event. This is such a great pleasure to host people from all over the world. We have delegates all the way from Japan, China, Norway, Sweden, and many, many other countries around the world. So thanks for making the time to be here. This should be an exciting event for all of us. We are hoping to create a community of industry and academic scholars so that we can engage in this discussion on such an important topic at this time for the history of this country and for many countries around the world, where hospitality and health and senior living and design are intersecting, and hopefully we can all together think of ways to create a more healthy and bright future. So that's the objective here. So welcome. We have an exciting panel this morning. Let me introduce the moderator for the first panel, Melissa Siriali. Melissa is connected with our university in many different ways. She is, in her title, you'll see, if you can read on the stage, it says P15, 17, 19, or something like that. That means she's parent of the children who we have the honor of teaching here. So thanks for bringing them here. She's also an advisory board member of Montefiore Medicine and one of the founding advisory board member of Cornell Institute for Healthy Future. Melissa? And now my job is done. It's all up to her.
So I have the pleasure this morning of hosting the panel of hospitality in healthcare. So we have three panelists with us this morning, and I will first introduce Dr. Phil Oswa, my colleague at Montefiore Medicine, of which I'm on the Board of Trustees. So Phil is the COO of Montefiore Medicine. As a brief recap, all the profiles for our panelists are in your information. So just a little bit of something that's not printed on them. Montefiore Medicine has about 100,000 inpatients a year, 7 million ambulatory visits, 36,000 employees, about 18 hospital campuses, and over 250 ambulatory locations located throughout the Bronx, Westchester County, and Rockland County. We have about 600,000 visits to our ERs every year, almost 500,000 of them on our main campus in the Bronx. It's a $7 billion health system, and with that, I will welcome Dr. Phil Oswa to the stage. Thank you. You're welcome. So here, representing Columbia, New York Presbyterian, the Columbia campuses, Andrea Castellanos. Did I say it right? I got it. Okay. Columbia, or NYP, the Columbia campuses, they have about 130,000 inpatients, 800,000 ambulatory patients, 26,000 employees, about 350,000 visitors to their ER every year. They have about a 66% government payer mix, and I failed to mention that at Montefiore we have an 85% government payer mix, Medicare and Medicaid. Andrea has got two medical schools that she operates in between, and they're about a $7 billion health system. Andrea, please.
And I have a son in the school also.
Yes, Andrea has a better son than mine because her son stayed for this and my son is off on his fall break. So our last panelist today is Peter Yesowich. Thank you. Peter is representing the American Cancer Treatment Centers of America, thank you, sorry, where they have five hospitals nationally. They handle principally advanced stage cancer patients. They're the only one with a national footprint. They have about 15,000 patients, and the majority of their patients fall into an older age range. They are consistently rated among the highest in the HCAHPS scores, They have predominantly commercially insured patients, unlike the other two panelists up here on the stage. So with that, Peter, please.
We're going to shake hands on our presidential candidates.
That's right. Let the debate begin.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you. Okay. So a lot of the conversation that we're hoping to have here today is talking about how we bring hospitality into healthcare and why it's important that we do so. So let's start right here next to me, and we'll work our way down. Peter?
I'm delighted to. Good morning. Just a little more on CTCA. We have about 6,000 employees, and we have been in business now for about 26 years. In fact, Carolyn Lammersfeld, Carolyn, raise your hand, where are you, is our Vice President of Integrative Oncology. Has a wonderful and fascinating background, so I hope that during the course of the next 2 days you'll have a chance to say hello. The question is, why are we here? And I will answer that very simply by saying I think in the transformation of the healthcare world that has occurred, not necessarily since the arrival of the Affordable Care Act here in the U.S., but really prior to that, that I think every healthcare provider has come to the conclusion, whether or not they like it, that we all compete for patients. And as a result of that, I think naturally the conversation turns to how well you serve patients. And that then takes us directly to this question of, well, what is the difference between patient care and patient service or guest service, and hence the integration of the concept of hospitality with healthcare. And I've kind of marveled at how that has occurred over the course of the past couple of years, because previously, quite honestly, we've all had these experiences in our own healthcare journey, where the emphasis first and foremost has to be on clinical excellence. We all understand that. But now it goes well beyond that to understand that the way we serve those patients to help them do things like manage the stress, facilitate the logistics, enhance their well-being, apart from the clinical procedures that we provide, are essentially very important. And I'll just conclude by saying that we all know with the explosive use of the internet, and we track that very, very carefully in our company. In fact, we have cancercenter.org, which is our website, is the most frequently visited cancer care provider site in the world. We have about 2.5 million unique visitors a month that come into cancercenter.org. And we actually can track the behavior from people who come visit us online all the way through decisions to treat. And the headline there very simply is, we have far more enlightened patients than we ever have before. And that's not just in terms of diagnostics and treatment, but that's in terms of their understanding of the quality of care. So the headline for me is, we all understand that we have much more engaged, informed, enlightened patients who are looking beyond the issue of the quality of the clinical care, which is the mandatory, to say, how well will I be treated, and how well will my journey through that treatment be managed. And that's an issue of quality and competition.
It's interesting that you're very much at a dichotomy with the other two panelists that we have on the stage. Who your patient base is, the education level of of the patient base.
Yep.
So let's pass it down the pike here.
Sure.
Andrea.
Sure. Well, Phil and I are very jealous of your payer mix. Yes. So what I mean by that is Phil's payer mix is 85% government, Medicare, Medicaid. Our payer mix at New York Presbyterian is 66% Medicare and Medicaid. And what that means to us from a financial perspective is essentially we lose money on Medicare and Medicaid. And so we make it up from a financial perspective, we make it up on the commercial payer base. Many of you in the audience are all commercially insured. You're the kinds of patients that help us with our bottom lines. And so protecting that payer mix for us, for all of us, is really important. Why is that difficult for us in terms of customer service and hospitality, et cetera? It's expensive to have good customer service. We look at some examples out there in the hotel world, the Ritz-Carltons as an example, where when you're a customer at the Ritz can charge you for those services. When you're a customer at NYP or Montefiore or our hospitals, we can't really charge you extra for those kinds of services. And so there's a certain level of training that we need to give to our employee base. In hospitals, employees have worked there for many years, right? We, you know, the average length of employment is in a hospital is probably 20 to 25 years, something like that. And so we're working with an employee base that's used to things from 25 years ago, from 30 years ago. And 30 years ago, we never talked about whether a customer or a patient was happy. We never talked about that. We just talked about whether we made them better or not. That was the only measurement we cared about. And now all of a sudden, we have to care. And why do we have to care? Because the government pays us to care. So we get reimbursed based on how happy our patients are. And so it's a very big challenge for us from an employee training perspective to who we take care of, and even the surveys themselves. I'll leave some for Phil about. But the surveys themselves, we take care of, for example, at New York Presbyterian, we take care of many Hispanic patients. Now, Hispanic patients, according to the government, are happier patients. I don't understand that, but they're happier. So they answer the surveys that the government gives them. They answer better. And so the government penalizes us for that because they've done research and they know that these patients are actually happier. So in the end, we get penalized. I'm sure you do too for that. I'm going to turn it over to Phil to sort of finish it out.
It's okay. I mean, I agree with everything Andrea just said. It's all of those things, and then trying to do this and train people to serve patients in the context of where they have other things on their mind. So I went to a conference on customer service that Melissa took me to in Atlanta. This is a high-end Forbes travel customer service, stayed at the Mandarin Oriental in Atlanta, a wonderful experience. It was clear to me from the moment that I walked in that everybody was focused on my comfort and my experience. Now, in the hospital setting, such as like, you know, the ones up here, but you know, Andrea's in mind, you have employees that are focused on 100 different things. A nurse can be in with a patient, and on her mind, she knows that the patient next door is bleeding in their brain, and she's thinking through, have I done all the things? You know, should I run back and check the vital signs? At the same time, as she's supposed to worry about this patient, or he's supposed to worry about this patient, and meet the same standards of attention and care. So the challenge that we have is, how do you do all of that in the context of real life and death, top of mind focus of staff who sometimes just, you know, I just need to get the bad heart out and put the good one in. I'll worry about introducing myself later, but right now let's, you know, get you into the room. So we face all of those challenges, and yet we have to, the patients appropriately expect a Mandarin Oriental service and a Mandarin Oriental level of attention. And incidentally, the government expects that as well. And part of our payer mix is that not only do we not get reimbursed for providing additional hospitality services, we actually, you know, get our reimbursements cut if the patients are not highly satisfied. So those are the challenges, but it's ones that, you know, that we embrace because we have to, and And that's part of the reason that I'm here, is to learn as much as I can about how, you know, how we can do this better.
Andrew, with my Montefiore hat on for a moment, I never thought I'd be envious of somebody who had 66% government payer mix, where we're at 85%. So this is an interesting panel, as you can see. We've got two ends of the spectrum here. Peter, I didn't mean to cut you off. You were going to say.
I would like to respectfully disagree with my colleagues.
Okay.
Okay. We're going to liven this up a little bit here. Good patient service does not cost you anything. In fact, poor patient service costs you a lot. And I think if you take that perspective and you say it's an issue of establishing the priority, this is important, training people appropriately, and then monitoring and recognizing that, that doesn't cost a lot of money. It makes a huge difference, though, in the experience that patients have. So I would challenge the group to maybe think differently about this. You're not adding expense. You're adding, really, a dimension of service that we know increasingly, not just through our organization, but any that's represented in this room, that clearly can make a difference in the experience patients have.
This is going to be very
a quick
exciting
story.
It'll be
right?
Very exciting.
A quick story, and I think hopefully you'll appreciate this. I joined the board of this company back in 1998, and the reason that I was asked to join the board was at the time they were very interested in understanding how you use the principles of marketing to grow the business. A month after I joined the board, a guy by the name of Horst Schulze joined the board. Some of you may recognize that name as the chairman of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company. The reason he was asked to join the board, because he believed in what I just said, and that is that good service doesn't cost you. It's an attitude. It's a belief, and it has to be imbued in the organization. And as it turns out, that has to do with a lot of the things you're talking about in the conference today, whether it's the ambient design and all the things that affect the way people react to their environment. But I guess what I would like to really impart to the group is to say, don't be burdened by the idea that this is adding expense and complexity. It's adding a dimension to the patient experience that you want and I want, and all the patients that we serve want. And it's just a question of calibrating the time and the attention you devote to that.
Okay, Peter, your 2 minutes are up. Phil?
Right.
I think the
mindset is the right one. But as the chief operating officer of a $7 billion health system, I can tell you that it costs us a lot of money. I have 10,000 nurses, registered nurses, to train them to go over, you know, just to master a script of coming, you know, say your name, say what you do, ask for the patient, you know, do you need anything? I can't train them when they are on duty in the hospital. And they don't volunteer their time to come in after work to be trained. I have to pay them. And these are highly expensive employees that you take out and you pay them time and a half to go through hours and hours of training. It undoubtedly hits our bottom line. And if you take them off of duty, which we do with the physicians, we don't pay the physicians overtime or anything like that for training, but you take them off of providing care. There's an opportunity cost because they're not seeing patients and generating revenue as you do that. It's not the toiletries and things that cost the money. It's actually the time. And part of what we learned in Atlanta, there's a new software that's being developed, which I have on my phone, and I'm piloting, that allows for interactions with scenarios with real people, and it rates you on your emotional connection and confidence and calmness and all that. And we're piloting this to see if we can use it for our patients. Well, Forbes Travel, that produces this, has a business model. When I estimate how much it will cost us, you know, it costs several hundred dollars per employee per year to use this service. When you multiply that by 36,000 employees, et cetera, so there is there's a definite cost that we experience, and we embrace, and we try to find ways to do it. But in certainly Montefiore's experience, it is real and it is substantial, and it's challenging.
So I agree with both of my colleagues.
Okay, wait a minute.
I think ultimately,
she's a politician.
I am a politician. I have to be. Two medical schools, one hospital. It's crazy. Okay. But ultimately, you're right. I think there's a payback, and it doesn't really cost anything. But we are challenged with so many difficulties, and here's where you in the audience can help hospitals like ours that really struggle with this. So the first thing we have to care about when people come to our facility is hopefully getting them better. We also have to keep them safe. So a hospital like mine that's located in one of the poorest communities in the country, people come from all over the country, all over the world to seek their care with us. We have 400 security officers, a large police force for any city, right? So just keeping our patients safe is a priority. When our patients come to us, they speak hundreds of different languages, and here's where the hotel and hospitality industry does this really well, and hospitals not so much. In hospitals, we're regulated, right? So we must have a translator, must. We break the law if we don't have a translator for hundreds of different languages. And so not every hospital or hospital system is faced with these kinds of challenges that both Phil and I are faced with. So we have the whole communication problem. And I think hotels and hospitality industry has probably done a much better job with this. I think the other thing that the hospitality industry does, for example, in Disney, they know where their customers are. We don't know in our hospital, and Phil's laughing, we can't find our patients. We don't know where, we don't have tracking devices on them. We don't exactly know where they are and when they're en route and what's going on. And I think that's another very big problem for us where the hospitality industry can actually be helpful for us. So there's all these things that make an experience good for a patient, not necessarily the ones we're thinking of. And then there's the whole arrival and departure thing. You know, how do you answer the phone? How do you arrive a patient? How do you say goodbye to a patient and a family? And then finally, it's the whole family experience. It's not just the one patient. And the hospitality industry does this well. You're not just nice to the person paying the bill. You're nice to the whole family, the whole group. Hospitals don't do that so well, where we have to take into account and really start to think about the whole experience with friends and families. And I think those are areas where opportunities for hospitality industry to really help hospitals.
Peter, you have 30 seconds to rebut.
This is not a rebuttal. Let me ask that you think maybe differently about the situation here. And the reason I say this is I am not a clinician. I've observed the work of clinicians now for many years and sat in many discussions and debates and so forth. But here's the analogy I'd love to give you. My assessment is that the healthcare industry in this country today looks an awful lot like the hotel business did in the late 60s. And what I mean by that is essentially there were no national brands, one size fit all. We had a very similar approach to delivery of service. As the industry matured, some remarkable things happened. We began to see brand distinction, differentiation. We began to see customer segmentation, different customers for different events, paying different amounts. That's precisely where the healthcare industry is going to go. And as a result of that, and it's forced by some of the issues that you've just articulated, which I agree with, but as a result of that, that's to me the wisdom of connecting hospitality with healthcare, because you put the two of those together and you say, well, how do you compete in that environment? There are going to be customers that want that Ritz-Carlton style healthcare experience. There are going to be customers that want the Super 8 quality healthcare experience. That's a reality. So what we have to do is we think about the maturation of this industry is to say, well, where does that fit with the whole idea of the integration of hospitality and healthcare?
Well, I might have a little bit of pushback on that, and that I don't know too many people who would say, only maybe it's just your use of words, who would want the Ritz-Carlton experience and who would want the Super 8 experience. Everybody wants the Ritz-Carlton, but the ability to pay automatically filters out. And when you're in a highly stressful medical situation, it's even more terrifying.
Yeah, one, and I agree with you, and this is the other aberration, I think, in this business, that the consumer is not the purchaser, if you think about that. So the person who purchases the healthcare services is typically not the consumer. It's the payer, right, who's the purchaser.
Correct.
Okay, and that's obviously going through a whole transformation, too. But anyway, just think about that quietly, because I think it takes you to some interesting places in terms of the importance of the principles of hospitality.
Right. I see Phil down here.
I think that you've highlighted a very important dimension here, Peter, which is that every patient that comes through Montefiore into the inpatient setting desires a private room. Almost none of their health plans pays for a private room, and the patients often are not willing to pay out of pocket for a private room. So you get dinged on privacy, you get dinged on noise, because somebody else is being cared for, there's a monitor in the room, so I can't always sleep at night, you know, quietly, and so on. And that's the challenge, I think. If we had a system where patients actually knew what things cost, you know, like patients come in and say, I want an MRI, I have a headache, I'd like an MRI, and now they may pay $20 towards the MRI, but as was pointed out, somebody else is paying the cost. And the person who's paying the cost, employers mostly, and the government, are all saying, we can't afford this anymore. And they're dialing down aggressively how much they pay. And so that's the challenge. If it was a completely free market, where, you know, when I go into a, you know, Radisson residence home, I don't expect five people waiting on me every minute that I go, nor do I pay for that. When I'm at the Ritz, it's a different experience, and you spend it, and that's exactly right, Peter.
I think that the other challenge we have in healthcare that probably the hospitality industry doesn't have so much of is the regulatory environment that we live under. Mm-hmm. And so in my hospital, we have regulators in our hospital every single day. Every single day. I know you do too. Because our hospitals are located less than 20 miles away from each other. So we know each other's service area. We're very similar in that way. And so from a regulatory perspective, up until about 15 years ago, New York State did not allow hospitals to build private rooms. Did not allow it. So we all in New York City, because space is the final frontier, right? We all have hospitals with double rooms. And then there's some single rooms. There's a few on every unit just sprinkled around. And then the regulator said, oh, wait a second, this is really bad for infections. So now if you build a new hospital in New York, you have to build single rooms. Have to build single rooms. You can't build double rooms. So all of us are stuck with double rooms. Yet we get rated by the government on noise and privacy and all of those things, which are virtually impossible for us to compete against. You probably have all private rooms, right? In your cancer centers?
Yes.
Right. So we're so different that it's almost impossible to compare us in many ways. So the regulatory environment is brutal, particularly in New York State. It's brutal. So that's all I'll say about that.
Yes, sir.
And I understand and I agree with that. And I think that really, I think, underscores what I was trying to express. And that is that if you take the view that kind of one size fits all in terms of delivery, it takes you to that place. But if you pause that and say, well, wait a minute, maybe there are different groups of patients defined by whether it's disease type, it's insurance type, whatever it may be, where you have different clusters who are seeking different things. It takes you to a different way of thinking. And that's exactly what the hotel business did, right? And all I'm suggesting is that if you think about that, it will take you to a place that I think is really quite imaginative in terms of understanding how to stay in front of the patients and offer them things that they would find compelling, at the same time, you know, integrate this concept of hospitality. So that's all. I think we're in violent agreement. I think it's just a question of how you size the market.
I mean, I think the other challenge, and we've all done this, we've set up centers of excellence where we could manage smaller groups of patients that are similar and apply some concierge medicine to those patients. And we've done that in clusters. So, for example, we have spine patients who come to us for spine surgery, or cardiac patients who come for, you know, percutaneous valves or open heart procedures, or neuro patients. But the majority of our patients are general internal medicine. Over 50% of our patients are general internal medicine. They're the patients that are out in the community that come into our ER that are sick. And those are the patients and the experience we struggle with. I think that's
right. And I agree. I think that if the market evolves to the scenario that's being talked about here, it would make it a lot easier to achieve these goals. Now, we still, you know, go after it, and I'll tell you something in a minute about the importance of research. But may I just ask, how many people in the audience now have a company, a school, somebody else funding your attendance here today? How many, can I see here? And so most people, and so a few are paying out of pocket, but imagine though, this is the scenario that we face. You know, whoever is paying and funding your stay here has said, I'm not paying for a private room for you at the Statler Hotel.
I have to share a room.
Yes, and so when you checked in, you were assigned to a double room, and you didn't pick your roommate. So we assign somebody else into that room who's going to come and go as they please, maybe playing music at 2 a.m. or have an alarm beeping. Well, that's the experience when you come into a hospital with double rooms. You're walking into a room with a complete stranger, different sort of moaning and groaning, and you're supposed to have a good experience. Now, the research, though, has been extremely helpful to us, because part of the cost of training that I mentioned earlier is that we're constantly experimenting. So people come in and say, why don't you do it this way? If you do this, you know, this will really be helpful. Incidentally, as I found out in Atlanta, the Ritz-Carlton, the Mandarin Orientals, they spend a ton of money training their people. What we don't know is, of all the 67 components of the training, which ones work the most, because they haven't necessarily studied it in that way, so that we can just take out the six that work. I'll give you one example. So we have a children's hospital that's consistently ranked in the top 1-5% in the country in terms of patient experience. It has a lot of private rooms because it was built as a newer hospital, but also we were rated very lowly on time that clinicians spent with patients, in particular doctors. Now, our residency training director at the time, Dr. Skay, found a study that showed that if a doctor stood in the doorway for 5 minutes and spoke with a patient, and another doctor pulled up a chair and sat down for 5 minutes at eye level with the patient, that the patient estimated that time spent with them as much longer with the person who sat down than the one who was standing in the doorway. And when Adam bought chairs, little chairs for doctors to sit down at eye level with our little kids, and insisted that everybody do that. And our scores went through the roof. Now, that's because there was science that drove us in that way. But for most of the rest of the things that we do, we don't have that level of empiricism. I'm not going to rig us. So we've brought in Disney to our place. We've brought in the Ritz-Carlton. We've brought in the Danny Meyer, restaurant group. They all come in with a whole package and menu and a big price tag to say, well, here's how we do it. We're going to take your team and put them through this year-long, 18-month-long process with practice. So the more that science and empiricism emerges from a group like this, the easier it would be for us to take elements of those and try to translate them at lower cost.
Yeah, Phil, I think you're right. I think this is, again, where the hospitality industry, through research, can help healthcare. So we think we know certain clues about what makes the experience really good for a patient and family. One of the big buzzwords now is empathy, right? Empathy is big. Can you teach empathy? I don't know. We none of us have figured out whether you can actually teach somebody or 26,000 bodies to be particularly empathetic, right? So the other thing that plays a crucial role for us, patients tell us this, but we're not sure whether this links to their experience, is the clergy, right? The rabbis and the priests and the clergy that are there during the most sensitive moments of patients' lives. And so all of us have rabbis and priests and clergy, and we have every, in New York, yes, we have every kind, every type, yes, you name it. It didn't really seem to make a big impact. And the thing that is challenging for us is it almost seems like no matter what we do, no matter how much resources, the Disney, the Ritz, we have Disney, we have Ritz also, we're not moving the mark in the way we would like to.
Or in the way that we need to.
Or the way we need to.
Based on the new government challenge or restrictions that they've given us. Yes, Peter.
Let me offer a thought that might be helpful. I personally have been amazed at the lack of insight that exists generally in healthcare in terms of understanding what patients really want. And that's unique to obviously their disease type and their age and so forth. But one of the things that we've done that has proven to be incredibly helpful is we invest in understanding what patients' expectations are. And that's a different idea than asking them what they want. And let me just explain the difference. If I said to you, rank these 10 things in terms of their importance to you when you seek care for orthopedics or something, you'll do that and I'll get the answer and say, well, that's great, we got an insight, we can move from there. Here's a different way of doing that. I ask you what expectations you have along a number of variables, and then I ask you about your experience. So what I do is I calculate the difference between the expectation and the experience, and I look at the gap. And then what I do is I rank the gaps and I say, well, can we affect this one? And what happens is it takes you to a really interesting place. I'll give you an example. In cancer care, every year we poll about 1,000, not our patients, but 1,000 cancer patients, a very meticulously designed survey, and we look at 29 predictors of satisfaction. We look at expectations and experiences. The number one thing, the gap, that we've discovered, you might think it's, well, the availability of advanced genomic testing or immunotherapy or spiritual support, whatever. The number one thing is the lack of the coordination of care. And that is people don't know where to go, where to show up for an appointment, how am I going to get here, how do I get my medical records, you know, that kind of thing. We said, wow, we never knew that. So all of a sudden you can focus on that and say, wow, what can we do to coordinate care, because, and we do that, and then make that a focus. And what that does is that really allows you to put the spotlight on some things that will hopefully really improve the patient experience. It's a different way of thinking
about it. Yeah, no, care coordination is certainly, I think, something that we're all trying to do. And in many respects, again, this is something that the hospitality industry does really well, the concierge, making sure that the customer knows where things are, where they're supposed to be, where their next move is, what's going on. There's a price tag to that.
Understood.
There's a price tag to that. And I could probably have 300 care coordinators, even more, in my hospital, and it probably wouldn't be enough. And so again, it's weighing what you can invest, what, you know, in terms of, it does cost money, and what's the benefit? I think there's great benefit to care coordination, and I agree with you on that.
Right, I think that the method that's being described is absolutely the right one. I mean, in terms of, by Peter, in terms of combining quantitative and qualitative surveys, if you will, of clients' expectations, as well as what the gap is between expectation and experience. And we have done this in small pockets, not in an entire system, and we've had remarkable success. One of our smaller hospitals has a very high response rate, high satisfaction rate for nurse responses, and that's because they spent a lot of time working with patients and understanding what it was that patients needed. And so now, rather than, and understanding that when a patient rings a call button saying, I need to use the bathroom, patient who needs assistance, that they expect somebody to appear right away, and not understand that the nurse could very well be with another patient and it may take him or her 10 minutes to get out and get there. And so the way that they've overcome that is they round every 40 minutes with patients and come in before the call button is rung and say, you know, do you need to go to the bathroom? Because sometimes people don't experience the urge to go, if you're morphine and other medicines, until the bladder is, you know, really full. Not to get too physiologic, but for most of us, the first urge is at about 50% full, which, you know, gives you a warning, and then at, you know, 75-85%. Now, for some patients, it could be close to 100%, which means there's an accident if you don't go right away, and that then ruins the entire
experience
for everything. It doesn't matter what else happened during that stay. Now, for a larger system, though, eliciting those, you know, those kind of empirical data ourselves, not to keep harping on it, is fairly expensive. Just, you know, with, you know, 7 million patient encounters a year, we spend millions of dollars on our own surveys, not the government surveys, and you get a 15% response rate, 10% response rate, which means you have to do several, because, and that may not be representative at all of everybody's experience. It could very well be a sliver, which we worry about, of the happiest patients respond, and then the most unhappy patients who are motivated to respond, and you don't get a picture. So to do waves and waves of these things requires some investment of resources and so on, which we constantly try to do.
I'd really like to suggest that all this great survey and empirical data that you found and are working on is shared with the other end of the panel at some point.
Happy to do it.
That would be very valuable information for a segment of the industry that doesn't have the resources or ability to do so. So we have a lot of major challenges. As I'm sitting here listening to this, sounds to me like the School of Hospitality Administration and this institute and the work we're doing needs to be incorporated right into some of the medical schools like Cornell Weill and Einstein Medical, wherever across the country, because we need to be training these employees with hospitality skills right at the very beginning as a suggestion. So is this an appropriate time to maybe open this up to take some questions from the audience? Here we have in the back row, please.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is a question or a comment, but one thing that I heard all of you struggling a little bit with is the language. So is the person a customer or a patient? And I know from talking and doing research about the patient experience that most patients don't want to be called customers. They don't want to think of themselves in a healthcare system as a customer or a consumer. They want to be cared for, perhaps a client, or in the case of elder living, a resident. But it's something that we have to think about, the patient experience, the customer experience, but perhaps use different language, which can really be tough on the mind, how to deal with all of that at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Up until, I'd say, probably 10 years ago, we never thought of patients as customers. But as the government has asked us to start to think of our patients more as customers, and quite frankly, as other industries have advised us, we've started to sort of interchange the word customer and patient. And I think you're right, patients want to be patients. But on the other hand, they have very high expectations that resemble the kind of customer experience. So I think it's a great point, and how we refer to our patients, I mostly use patients, but I think it's been a shift over the last 10 years.
Oh, yes, it has.
Perhaps it's also about shifting the mindset of the patient to think of themselves as being empowered. So, it could be a paradigm shift where they feel like, yes, I am a consumer and I do have a say in my treatment. So it could be a big difference, but we as healthcare providers have to be really careful.
Right, but I think, right. And I agree. Listen, I don't know, does anybody here know about who the CEO of Montefiore was 30 years ago? Good, because I'll tell you what he said to me and what he would say, which was, if a patient sometimes, at that time, our food was terrible at Montefiore. It's phenomenal now. We actually get the highest rating. But his attitude was, by the time that you're well enough to taste the food, you should be home. But we get rated on the food now. So.
Yes, we have a question here. Yes.
I do have a question, and I just want to follow up with what you said. Why do we call them guests? Both the doctor, the nurses, the people who come in and take care of them, anybody. Why don't we just call them guests, like the Ritz-Carlton does, okay? I feel much better being a guest than I would a patient, and I definitely don't like the word customer. It doesn't, it doesn't appeal to me at all. I feel like I'm in a dime store and you're calling me a customer, okay? So anyway, that's from a hotel.
Yes, sir.
Well, coming from the hospitality side, the way the hospitality industry has achieved all the things that you try to do is through process and technology. Peter almost went there with levels of care. The growth industry in hospitality right now is called select service. And this is taking a business model that operates with fewer people and more process, more technology. That spawned from the large boxes, large hospitals that you're talking about, being able to manage people and manage process. So it's a matter of just, you're not hiring nurses to be diplomats, you're hiring them to save lives. But there's a layer of process, a layer of technology that makes a mediocre employee look great. And that's the hospitality industry. Also, by the way, Mandarin Oriental has only 11 pillars of service that they teach all their employees.
You know, but a little bit of that shift is happening in the healthcare landscape as well, where we're moving away from inpatient service to an ambulatory model.
Yeah, but if I may just respond, that healthcare is being pushed in the opposite direction, which is that, and it's not just my opinion, if you look at Moody's, you know, assessment, Standard & Poor, it's virtually impossible for small, medium-sized hospitals to survive anymore. You don't have the leverage with purchasing. You pay the most for the same thing that other people pay the least for, and the payers pay you the least because they can afford to pay you the least. You can't pay Andrea's hospital the least because you couldn't get patients to sign up with a health plan in New York City if you say Presbyterian Columbia is completely excluded and all of their network. So the economic pressures, when you have consolidation of health plans, which there are very few left, believe it or not, they're buying each other and applying tremendous pressures on healthcare system, then the systems are being pushed in a direction to have scale and economies of scale and leverage and muscle that's going away from more intimate in a small setting into larger and larger systems. And I think in the end, suddenly all the experts and economists out there are saying that they're going to end up with very large hospital systems because of the pressures. I think there were other
things. You know, I just one comment. I really like what you said about using technology to make a mediocre employee a great employee. And the one thing that many hospitals don't do well, we have very clunky technology, very, very clunky technology. There are reasons for it. There are historical reasons. If you wanted to replace the IT system in my hospital, overall 100%, it's $1 billion.
Yeah.
$1 billion with a B. But I do think that there are technologies that can be overlaid that we could take from the hospitality industry and overlay it. We do things like, I know you do this much better than us at Cancer Center, but things like linen, things like when one of our patients or guests requires an extra pillow, it's a monumental task to get I still haven't figured it out, but it's a monumental task to get a patient a pillow and a blanket and a sheet sometimes. Or it feels that way when that patient doesn't get it. So I do think there are technologies that are out there that we could apply in the hospital industry that could benefit us.
Let me say one thing here. What's interesting to me when we talk about bringing hospitality into healthcare, it's really easy for, well, I think the fallback is to say, well, we need to have concierge level service. And there are so many challenges within the medical industry. I look at some hospitals that have a concierge level, and so the patient comes in and they pay more out of pocket for that, and they think that they're getting great medical care. But you look at it, that patient is there for a very specific reason. And now they're shuttled off to a separate floor where the specialists that they need to be taking care of them are not on that floor. So it's very complicated and difficult.
I mean, that's
scenario.
A great point. We have a beautiful concierge unit at our hospital, two of them, one on our uptown campus, one on our downtown campus. And people, you know, always want to be there, and they're willing to pay, and they'll ask me, well, I want to go to this unit, and I say, go where your doctor tells you to go. Yeah. Because you might be too sick to get the right care on that unit. You just might be too sick, and we want you where all your specialists are, and it may not be that, you know, high-end concierge unit.
Can I offer a comment?
Yeah, we have a lot of questions out there, so
just
comments
on the gentleman that made the comment a moment ago about the hospitality analogy. I think one of the other things that is occurring across the stage here is the rate at which the delivery of care and the venue of delivery of care has changed. And that is, you know, we've grown up traditionally with big box hospitals, and for example, just in oncology care, roughly 80% of that is outpatient. And traditionally, patients have come to the hospital to get chemotherapy, for example. Half of the agents that are being developed at this point, targeted drugs at this point, are oral chemotherapies. So the idea is you can take a pill at home. You don't necessarily have to travel to the hospital to do that. That has forced thinking about alternative methods of the physical delivery of care. And that's what I think we need to think about. Now, in your application, and I'm sure you've given this some thought, I've been kind of a student of this and fascinated by it, is the whole concept of the delivery of telemedicine, right? And the idea that someone who would show up in one of your emergency rooms because they got a bad head cold or they have a bruise or whatever, I mean, you could eliminate that visit if you had a facility whereby you could immediately engage them through some kind of telemedicine facility. And as you're probably aware, there's lots of investment capital going behind that those services today. So I would watch that very carefully, because what I think is going to happen is this rapid transformation of the way we deliver care through the use of technology, which is going to reinvent the places that people have to go to get the care. And I think that's swirling around us right now, and it's going to become increasingly clear probably in the next couple of years. And will really alter, you know, the kind of the inpatient services that you provide. Certainly will for what we do.
Yeah. We have about 5 minutes left, so who's going to wave most dramatically? Yes, ma'am. There we go. Thank you.
First, I wanted to offset some of what Naomi said with research that's out there. We did a study last year where we polled patients and said, do you think of yourself as a consumer of buying services or a patient needing services? Boomers as well as millennials said patients needing services. But if you ask them the question, what's more important, experience or just service, they say experience. So that dichotomy, we do have data.
Yes, I mean, in our patient satisfaction surveys, patients will tell us the food isn't so good and the, you know, you didn't really, my pain was pretty high and, you know, all these things. And they had an extraordinary experience and they would recommend us to all their friends. And so it's validated for us time and time and time again, but that's not, you know, you have to balance it. You could save somebody's life, you could do a heart and lung transplant, and if they had a bad parking experience, they're answering that survey. I'm serious. Right. They're saying they had a bad experience.
True, yep. That's true.
Because the point that was raised about expectations and experience, I think, is very key.
Yeah.
And you were asked about expectations. The other piece that I feel that we may lose an opportunity to talk about is maybe what hospitality can learn from healthcare. And flip that conversation, because somehow we put ourselves in a position where we are taking from a lot of industries. But the complexity of healthcare is not something that we can communicate very quickly. And the surveys that are happening to your top 15 and bottom 15 are posing a huge problem for us. So we do need the empirical research, but I also think that maybe the conversation is not hospitality moving to healthcare, but both of them going together to a different place. Because it's not working the way we are. We're solving for this patient satisfaction loop, and the patient doesn't know necessarily what they want because we're not asking the right questions in the surveys.
I couldn't agree more, and somebody was asking me last night about how they might get into, you know, transferring hospitality into healthcare, and I said, well, why don't you come down and sort of, you know, and we'll set up an experience for you, but, you know, but when you're standing in one of these critically ill floors and see how the staff, what they're dealing with and how they're moving, and that when they run past you without saying hello and making eye contact, and you're with them and you understand their justification for that and why they do what they do, and the level of tension that's there and their own anxiety and tension about making sure that nobody gets hurt and that the patient is safe. I'm trying to figure out that how do you, in that context, which is not a vacation, it's not simply a guest at a resort, how do you in that context still bring the other elements in? And then, and maybe hospitality can learn from healthcare, but how do you deal with crises, you know, when there's something?
And I don't want to bother you, but I want to continue that point where I think one of the patients, one of the survey respondents, or an interview respondent said that here's the thing, my ability to make choices when I'm sick is very low, and my incentive to make choices when I'm healthy is very low. So healthcare has a very different...
It's a big challenge.
It's a big challenge. And I'm healthy, I don't want to make choices when I'm sick, I'm not able.
I know Rohit is about to cut me off, but I've got one gentleman back here who's been waving desperately. Yes, sir.
As we seem to be moving to a nationalized healthcare insurance, and not that far off,
well, when you're talking about a single payer, a single payer will absolutely diminish service in hospitals like mine, in major academic medical centers like Phil and mine, because our reimbursement will be cut dramatically from a single payer system. I think it will devastate academic medicine.
Right, and by the way, I think that we may move to a single payer, but not in the way that you think, and it may be two single payers. There's the government single payer, but there's also the privately insured single payer, where the companies are buying up each other and becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, and therefore having extreme power and monopoly to produce returns and dividends. And there are only so many ways that one can do that. So, yes, we already, in many ways, deal with that at Montefiore. We're essentially with 85% Medicare. Well, we already have a single payer on the one hand, and the policies are not always aligned, Medicare's expectations and Medicaid's expectations. And in many ways, we're dealing with one or two big payers now. On the commercial end, they may have different names, anthem signals, but corporately they want. So, but all of this is being driven by the fact that that we're 17% GDP and it's unaffordable, and so something is going to have to
which shifts give. The landscape to why it's so important that we are changing the delivery of healthcare from having patients sick and in our hospitals and turning that to population health and keeping our population healthy and out of hospital situations. All right, you got to wrap us up, Peter.
Final note of optimism for the gentleman. I want to disabuse you of the notion that we will ever get to a single payer system. And the reason for that is I would ask every one of you in this audience, because you are not reflective of the demography of this country. I realize we have a number of international guests. Would you accept that? And I would tell you the answer is a resounding no. So what happens, I think, is we focus far too much on the supply side and we ignore the demand side. And when you look over the fence and you realize that there are different patients, different customers want different levels of care, and they're prepared to find ways to pay for it, and employers, by the way, I think it gives you a little bit of a sense of relief. So that, I'm sure people disagree with me, but a little note of optimism for you, sir. So.
I just say that walking in here, I had no idea that anybody would be interested in this panel. So I'm really surprised. I'm quite gratified. That level of interest. Thank you all.
Thank you to our panelists. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.